Countrywide on ABC Radio.
I'm absolutely calling on the Deputy Prime Minister to pay attention to his own report.
Growers work from sun up to sun down, so
Countrywide.
We need to speak to these growers 1 o'clock in the morning.
And to actually act on behalf of the farmers.
They're going to get it from the Yanks or the French or whoever. So let's get our foot in the door and let's be the first.
Countrywide, the politics of food and farming on ABC Radio.
Hello there, I'm Nikolai Bailhart. On today's program, how good are you at picking crop types? Could you pick out a tobacco crop if you saw one in the paddock? Well, they've been illegal for a decade in Australia, but it is now growing season, and the tax office is cracking down on production of the crop. Also on the show, wool growers are trying to get their bales to market as quickly as possible at the moment. The market has seen a significant bump in prices because of a disease outbreak on the other side of the world. But growers say they're putting most of their profits back into the farm.
I bought a ute on Friday, but the check's not here yet, but that's where some of it will go at least, and we've got a few dams to clean out and so on, so most of it will go back into the farm.
To start today though, if you've been pushing the trolley around the supermarket fruit and vegetable section lately, one thing has probably jumped out at you: high prices. After floods in Queensland and continuing drought in other parts of the country, the supply of vegetables has been hit particularly hard, with staples like broccoli now selling for as much as $9 a kilo in some areas. Sean Lindy from AusVeg says it is a pretty simple equation at the moment.
As I'm sure you and your listeners are aware, our industry is naturally a supply and demand driven industry, and that it is susceptible to extreme weather events. So when there are issues of supply, then demand increases, and as a result, there can be price increases as well. So what we saw sort of over summer, there was some very hot weather that affected some of southern Victoria's key growing regions. And as a result, there has been sort of what we're seeing now, some supply issues with some veg commodities.
So it's an interesting mix of, and I suppose an example of the extremes that we're seeing in weather at the moment heat in the southern part of Australia, but then obviously flooding in Queensland.
Yeah, that's right. There have been some quite extreme weather events around different parts of the country. You mentioned heat in Victoria, not to mention hail as well. If it's not hot weather, it's something else in particular growing regions. And unfortunately, that has led to some supply issues of some commodities. Not all, but some commodities at the moment.
Yeah, and just to run through a few of those, because we are seeing some pretty high prices for some commodities, like you say, not all of them, but a few examples that I've pulled up: broccoli at the moment going for about $8.90 a kilo at one of the major supermarkets, cabbages for $6 each, wombox for $8 each. They are pretty big jumps in prices.
Yeah, look, Nikolai, they are, and that can be expected from time to time, given the nature of our industry. What I will say is that most vegetables are grown in different regions around the country. So if there are supply issues in one region, it will take some time for another region to pick up the slack. So in the meantime, there will be sort of short-term price increases while those supply issues are resolved. But consumers can take to heart that it won't be too long before the supply issues are in fact resolved. And it should only be a couple of weeks until supply resumes to normal levels. And when supply does resume to normal levels, demand will and price will lower as a result.
And I have noticed too in some of the supermarkets now they'll actually put up, an A4 sheet of paper that explains, you might notice that there's fewer of this particular crop or this price has gone up because of a natural weather event. Do you think that helps? Does that help consumers understand what's going on?
Yeah, Nicole, I think that is a really good thing that the retailers are doing when there are issues either with supply or even if there's sort of aesthetic issues with some fruit and veg, just to let consumers know that the product that is available to buy is still high quality, it's still good, and it gives consumers a bit more information about what's actually happening on the ground. As I'm sure you're aware, there is a sort of a growing disconnect between the consumer and the farm, and any way that the retailer can give consumers a bit more information about what goes into their fruit and veg, it sort of goes a way to bridging that gap. And so hopefully that means that when consumers read that information, there's a bit of an understanding that sometimes prices may increase. And also an understanding that when that does happen, that it's a short-term thing. Because the last thing we want to see is consumers seeing if there's a a short-term price increase. And then as a result, we don't want to see consumers stop buying fresh fruit and veg altogether. We want to see consumers supporting local growers and supporting local industry. It's not only good for farmers and their communities, but it's also good for their health.
Is that of some concern that people just look at it and go, oh, it's too expensive, I'll turn to something else?
Look, I haven't heard that being the case. So sort of hope that consumers aren't seeing, you know, some of the commodities that you've listed before and being put off by buying fresh fruit and veg. I think if there's a bit more awareness about what's happening, you know, people in the market themselves also experience the weather. So I think there would be an understanding that there, you know, there are some short-term issues with some supply. You know, when the supply issues do resolve, prices will go back to normal. And hopefully we haven't seen in that time consumers stop buying fruit and veg, because, you know, while there may be some commodities that are a little bit higher in price, there are some that are actually still, you know, in really high supply and really you know, good value for consumers.
And just finally, I suppose the million-dollar question to a degree is how long will these high prices last, or when will we start to see things return to, I guess, what we'd expect to be a bit more normal?
Yeah, the how long these price rises will be, it can be hard to predict. What we do see in these situations is that any supply issues are short-term, and as a result, you know, it's a short-term price increase. So because, you know, we're lucky in the fact that we do grow majority of our fruit and veg here in Australia in different growing regions. So when there is one or more regions that are affected by weather, we do see some of the other regions picking up the slack. So look, I don't want to put a time on it, but you know, I'd be very surprised if in a couple of weeks supply issues weren't returning to what we would normally expect at this time of year. And as a result, then price should also reflect the supply.
Sean Lindy from AusVeg. Now, I wonder how good you are at identifying crops at a distance. Could you spot tobacco, a crop that hasn't legally been grown in Australia for more than a decade? Well, it is peak growing season for the illicit crop at the moment, which is traditionally found in places like central Victoria, southern New South Wales and Queensland, and most recently in the Top End. After a couple of significant busts, the tax office is now cracking down on chop chop, as it's known, with penalties of up to 10 years in jail for those who are found growing it. Assistant Commissioner Peter Vujinic told Kelly Buchanan farmers are already helping.
The number of referrals into our office has increased dramatically, and it is things like farmers contacting local police stations all directly through our system saying, look, we've got this crop, we're not too sure what it is, it may resemble kale or cabbage or corn. It's just some unusual activity around the farm. It's been leased, subleased, you know, it smells a bit different. And hence, I think the community awareness is really becoming quite cognizant of what illegal tobacco is.
Of course, there was that massive bust in Bundaberg last year. Has that also really put this issue in the forefront of these regional communities' minds? Because I know in Bundaberg it was quite a lot of shock when that story first broke.
Absolutely. And I really can't talk about the individual case, but for Bundaberg and that regional area, it has caused a bit of reaction so far as other farmers coming and going, look, we're not certain. There's a bit of labour production happening on the property. There's some suspicious activity. So I think the message is certainly getting out there. I'll be frank. I mean, Catherine, who would have thought that we would have a crop in the tip of Australia with a fairly substantial crop? So hence our campaign to educate all people within Australia what to look out for. But more importantly then, you've got something to do about it. You can contact an agency and we're taking it very seriously.
Now, some people might think, oh, you know, what's the impact of a bit of chop-chop, a few cheap ciggies? What's the broader impact of illegal tobacco growing in Australia?
Illegal tobacco trade in Australia for a number of years is very lucrative. The tobacco, the excise foregone on tobacco, almost 600 million tobacco duty was foregone in the 2015-16 period. So for a 12-month period, $600 million is significant, and we would argue strongly, well, that money is essential for community services, for our infrastructure, building schools and hospitals and roads akin.
So do you know who is making money from these crops?
So we have identified that there is organised criminal networks engaged across the East Coast through those key target areas. So it's not one individual, but there is organised criminal syndicates that we're obviously actively working with our partner agencies to obviously prosecute.
ATO Assistant Commissioner Peter Vujinic speaking there with Kelly Buchanan. Well, it seems to be a case of quick go the shears for farmers at the moment who are fortunate enough to have sheep ready to be shorn. With the wool market now riding above $20 a kilogram, growers are keen to get their wool out of the paddock and into the auction room very quickly. Cara Jeffrey reports.
Farmers are racing to get their sheep shorn as they want to cash in on the rising wool market. Josh Seach is currently shearing on his property near the Rock, but he's already spent the healthy wool check before it's arrived.
I bought a ute on Friday, Cara, but the check's not here yet, but that's where some of it will go at least, and we've got a few dams to clean out and so on, so most of it will go back into the farm.
So your wife hasn't booked in a holiday?
No, she doesn't like going anywhere, but yeah, I wouldn't mind going on maybe a little cruise. Hopefully the wool check will pay for that.
How many sheep are you shearing at the moment?
We're shearing about 1,400 ewes. Finished the crossbreeds last week.
Has the drought reduced your wool cut at all?
Yeah, it has to a certain extent. Numbers are back slightly and they're probably not cutting as much as you'd expect, but not a huge amount.
How many kilos would you be getting off on average on your merinos?
I think they're probably cutting about 6 or 7 kilos without too much trouble.
And what about for your crossbreds?
Yeah, they probably cut 4 or 5, and same story, they would have been a little better if we had better conditions.
And when will your wool hit the auction room?
I'm hoping in about 2 weeks, sooner if they could, while these prices are so good.
And did you think that the wool market would get up around the back up over the $20 a kilogram again?
No, I wasn't really expecting that, no. But it's, you know, it started climbing last year, so who knows where it will end up.
Have you been involved with the wool industry for a long time?
Yeah, ever since I left school, Cara. I started off in the shearing industry and I was in that for over 40 years. Yeah, so I've been involved with wool for a long time.
So you've seen plenty of highs and lows for the wool market?
Yeah, mostly lows. Probably first big high I can ever remember.
And when you hear news that there's been a foot and mouth outbreak in South Africa and it's shut down the market over there, is that a concern as a wool grower here that if something like that happened it would ruin things for you on your farm?
Oh, definitely. It's a huge worry. But luckily we're pretty lucky in this country for that at this stage.
With prices trending upwards, shearers are in high demand. Wagga Wagga based shearer Charlie Clayton explains.
There's plenty of work about, yeah. There's a lot of people calling for shearers and, yeah, a lot of work, so always flat out and can't get a break.
And how's your tally looking with the sheep being a bit drier and a bit harder going?
Oh, it's a bit hard with the dust. Use a lot of shearing gear, but yeah, it's not too bad. Poke along and still make a dollar.
The 21 micron wool clip is bound for the Sydney auction room, where it's expected to make big money when it's sold in a fortnight. Wagga wool broker Dave Payne.
Looking at it, around about $23 a kilo clean, so we bring that down, I reckon, about $14.50 greasy back to the growers.
And what's the mood among wool growers at the moment when you visit them?
Good, really, really upbeat. All they want now is a drop of rain.
A sentiment shared by Mr. Seach.
The only thing that's against us on the farm at the minute is the season, so the prices for everything are really, really good. Happy days.
Wool grower Josh Sheets speaking there with Cara Jeffrey.
From the top end to Tassie, Countrywide on ABC Radio.
Nikolai Bailhart's with you today. Well, there could be a game changer on the way for Australia's wheat industry. In a 7-year trial that's been led by La Trobe University and the CSIRO, wheat farmers planted crop varieties that are normally grown in the Northern Hemisphere. Now, at the moment, most of Australia's crop is made up of what are known as spring varieties that are sown, interestingly enough, in autumn to early winter, but which mature in late spring to early summer. However, if you use the overseas varieties and plant them at a different time of year, researchers say Australia could increase the national wheat crop by 20% and also upend a method used by growers for more than a century. Jess Davis explains.
Barry Haskins is a farmer and agronomist from Griffith in southern New South Wales. In between harvest and sowing, he's busy on the road visiting clients. He farms on one of the 16 sites which, for the past 7 years, has been growing winter wheat crops instead of the spring wheat normally grown in Australia.
And I personally believe that this is the next leap for us in terms of our potential yield.
Winter wheats are mostly grown in the Northern Hemisphere. They take longer to grow, but can provide higher yields.
We've unlocked a lot of our yield potential in some of the seasons. So we were very commonly getting double the yield of our spring sown wheats in a year where really traditionally we wouldn't have grown a lot of grain at all.
Associate Professor at La Trobe University, James Hunt, is the lead researcher of the trial.
The first paper you can find on it, it comes from 1937. So there's a bit of a history of it and there's been a few attempts at getting it to happen. But really we needed a lot of modern agronomic management to come along in order to be able to make it happen.
Using modelling, the research team found the national yield could be increased by about 20%. Worth up to $1.8 billion to the national economy. In Australia, wheat is typically sown in time for what's known as the autumn break, the first significant rainfall of the winter growing season, between April and June, depending on which part of the country you're in. But autumn rainfall in Australia has been declining since the 1990s, leading to a stagnation in wheat yields. The advantage of winter wheats is they can be planted months earlier than spring wheats. So if a farm gets rain in March or has lots of moisture in the soil from summer rains, the wheat can be planted then. Tim McClellan farms at Birdship in northwest Victoria.
With the variable rainfall, we're going to have to be more adaptable. So we're going to have to plant crops when we get those rainfall events. It's not ideal, but it certainly will help us in the long run if we have that flexibility and adaptability.
He has also been part of the joint La Trobe CSIRO study.
Anything that we can do to widen up that window is something that we're interested in.
But Associate Professor James Hunt says the real potential won't be unlocked until winter varieties, known as cultivars, are developed specifically for Australia.
We've had limited success thus far because what our research has shown is that growers could increase yields if they sowed winter wheats earlier, but the issue is that we don't have adapted winter varieties for a lot of the cropping regions, but there's breeding companies working on that. I'm hoping that we'll probably have a lot better cultivars than we have now within the next 2 or 3 years.
How important is that with a changing climate?
Well, if it could be realised, it would be hugely important because Australian growers obviously have to keep increasing yields so they can stay competitive with other lower cost producers.
Griffith grower Barry Haskins says winter wheats won't replace spring wheats entirely, but he believes the practice could be adopted across the country.
All of my clients will definitely have a crack at some of these, and I see no reason why all of the production areas in New South Wales or even Australia wouldn't adopt it. I do think that it's more valuable for bigger farms, where it might take, 30 sowing days to get across the program. That's where it really opens up that sowing window. And probably on top of that, in areas where we might store moisture between seasons through rotation, so 18-month fallows or that sort of stuff, just to try and access that moisture at depth, which we just can't tend to do with our spring wheats. So, yeah, I can't see a reason why it won't be adopted across Australia.
And he says there are some negatives to planting early.
One of the big negatives I will say is I think we got caught in 2002 to 2005 with wheat streak mosaic virus. So sowing wheats early, you can get other things go wrong, and that really devastated us for probably 5 or 6 years or even 10 years. People didn't have the confidence with the winter wheats because of that virus outbreak. People have got good memories about that, so we need to be making sure that we understand the negatives with it as well. So there's, it's not all business skittles, but I think with the right agronomy and the right thought processes that some of the winter wheats can do really well.
The research findings have been published in the journal Nature Climate Change.
Jess Davis with that report. Now, turning to the dairy industry, you might remember hearing a while ago about the idea of a milk price index. It was created by the federal government in order to provide additional information and market signals to dairy farmers, trying to give them a better idea of how much they should be paid for their milk. But the government has now acknowledged it's not working and will undertake a review in the coming months. It's been revealed that less than 40 farmers have submitted their individual price details to the website. Bega Valley dairy farmer Phil Ryan says it's of no use to dairy farmers.
It was basically a waste of money. It was predicated on a supposition that dairy farmers didn't have access to that information. And while it wasn't always easy to find and you had to go looking for it, the information was actually available. And it doesn't provide much that we didn't already have access to. Having the information doesn't allow us to change our business dramatically. I can't upscale my dairy farm or downscale my dairy farm based on global trade events in any easy way to and certainly not in a responsive way. It takes me 2 years to get a cow from calf to starting to milk her. It takes me 9 months to get a cow from start of a pregnancy to producing milk. It might take me 12 months to grow pasture. These can't be driven at a whim based on a global trade event and in dairy trade figures going up or down.
Steve Guthrie is the Dairy Connect representative for the Bega Valley, and he said the other part of the index that requires farmers to contribute their details is not being used.
Well, I think it's a fairly costly enterprise, really, and I don't think it's really delivered what it was meant to deliver in the first place. So it relies on farmers putting figures in, and I don't know that very many people use it at all, and I think it's, other than being a very costly exercise, I don't think it's been worthwhile.
Steve Guthrie, Dairy Connect representative for the Bega Valley, ending that report by Josh Becker. Well, it seems the United States is not the only country that wants to build a fence along its border. Denmark is in the process of building a 70-kilometre fence from coast to coast along the country's German border. The aim is to stop wild pigs coming in from Europe and potentially spreading a deadly pig disease called African swine fever. Cassie Huff explains.
In Denmark, pork production is big business. There are about 5,000 pig farms producing about 28 million pigs a year. The Danish Agricultural and Food Council's Jens Munk Ebbesen says it's worth millions to the country.
The food cluster, which is the food industry and agriculture cluster and so on, they have about 25% of this export. And out of that, I think about one-third of that is for the pig industry. So in value, the export of Danish pork out of Europe, out of the European Union, has a value of about 1.5 billion euros.
That huge economic impact is why Denmark is taking the threat of African swine fever very seriously. ASF is a contagious pig disease that's deadly to pigs and normally found in Africa. However, in the last couple of years, it's been found in Europe and Asia, including the most recent detection in Vietnam. Danish farmers have been given the okay to hunt wild pigs year-round in Denmark, but believe the wall is necessary to stop more entering from Germany.
We have seen the African swine fever making jumps in Europe, and every time it had made jumps over a longer distance, for instance from the eastern part of Europe to Czech Republic or to Belgium or to Hungary, it has been human beings moving foodstuff with virus in, throw leftovers in nature, and then wild boars have picked up these foodstuffs, leftovers, and got the virus. That's how we have seen the picture and seen the very big jumps in Europe.
Construction on the fence began earlier this year. It's a mesh fence about a metre and a half high, and it's expected to cost 10 million euros, and farmers will fund 4 million of that. It will stay up for 5 years, and in the meantime, farmers hope to remove all the wild pigs from the Danish side of the border. Environmentalists have raised concerns, though, about the disruption the fence could mean for the habitats of other wild animals.
There'll be some small holes for each, 100 metres, something like that, 20 times 20 centimetres for very small animals. Hares and so on can go through there, and all the deer, so they can jump over there.
Danish Agricultural and Food Council Director Jens Mock Ebbesen speaking there with Cassie Huff. And finally today, to one of the challenges that you might not think about in agricultural production. A central Victorian farmer has given up on producing free-range duck eggs because of the fickle nature of the animals. After producing and selling eggs for 4.5 years, he says the ducks are very sensitive to change and don't lay consistently. Jess Davis spoke with Harcourt farmer Jared Coote, who says it wasn't an easy decision.
Well, it was a long, anxious decision. We did our numbers many times over many months, but essentially what it came down to is the ducks were too inconsistent in laying. They would lay really well at some times of the year and really poorly at other times of the year, and we just couldn't run a business based on that supply model.
And is that normal for those kind of ducks?
It's reasonably normal. They go through a molt each summer, so they stop laying for anything up to 3, maybe even 4 months. You can shorten that period a little bit with increased nutrition, but it's still something that needs to be managed. So these ducks were an egg-laying breed. They were khaki Campbells, and they're quite good layers, but they just don't lay all through the year.
And how long did you have the ducks before you made that final decision?
We ran several flocks over about 4.5 years at different sizes and slightly different management systems, I suppose, and inputs to try and work out the best way to increase that or get better consistency throughout the year. And we did achieve some gains, but at the end of the day, the numbers just didn't stack up for the price that we could get for the eggs.
You mentioned before that the ducks can be quite sensitive to change.
Yeah, absolutely. They're a fantastic bird. They don't pick on each other. They're very harmonious. They chat away at night. And, you know, they're really quite pleasant to deal with. But any sort of change upsets them. And so if a fox attacks the birds, either during the day or at night, then egg production stops for a month and gradually climbs back up to where it was before. So that really impacts the business and really impacts our customers. A change of personnel can upset them as well. If a dog is a little bit, we use a kelpie to muster the ducks every night, put them away. You know, if that dog gets a bit excited or there's a different handler, such as a backpacker or something, then the dog upsets the birds and the lay rate will drop the following day.
And what was the market like that you were selling to?
It was actually pretty good. We had sales all through Melbourne and regional Victoria, but sales, some customers were quite large and consistent, and that was really good, and some customers were quite small and somewhat inconsistent, and it costs a lot of money to deliver small amounts of eggs to a lot of individuals, so that's a bit of a problem with that business model as well, whereas people, when they buy chicken eggs, tend to buy many dozen at a time. The shops that we were selling to would only buy 10 or 20 or 50 dozen eggs at a time.
And what about the Asian egg market in Melbourne that you were selling to?
Yeah, it's very, there's a lot of eggs, a lot of duck eggs sold in Melbourne. Asians particularly like their duck eggs. They sell a lot of preserved eggs. Many of those eggs are imported. There is a small number of eggs that are preserved in Australia or salted in Australia and sold. But there's a real floor price there. They're willing to pay a particular price for their eggs and no more. And that was not much more than our cost of production. That wasn't a business model we could really sustain. We were a premium operation. We were a free-range operation that needed a little bit more return, I suppose, to cover those free-range costs rather than a shed operation.
So is the duck egg market growing in and around Melbourne and Victoria? And given it's so hard, have you seen others enter the market or other farmers interested?
I think the market is very slowly growing. We had no trouble developing new markets, so we got non-Asian people interested in duck eggs and using them, and the eggs were a fantastic product. They were very much like a chicken egg, and they performed well in cafes and restaurants. But it would be we have seen some small backyarders sort of start and sell a few eggs and quickly disappear, but I could find there's probably only two other commercial duck egg farms in Australia. They keep a low profile and they're shed-based operations, one in Victoria and one in New South Wales.
And so what's next for your farm? You obviously have a few other different free-range animals.
We do. So we're a paddock-to-plate operation and we do beef, cattle and pork. So we'll continue, particularly with the pigs. We could probably run a few more pigs and replace that duck income with pork. So we're quite content with that, but we'll also do a little bit more off-farm work, I suppose, to supplement our income.
Harcourt farmer Jared Coote speaking there with Jess Davis. And for today, that is it for Countrywide. Remember, you can find details of all of our stories up on the website abc.net.au/rural. My name's Nikolai Bailharts. I'll speak to you again next week.